The date is February 4th, 1994, and we're watching Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me is the Emilio to my Ace.
What's up, everybody? I'm Colin Stewart.
So this week, we're looking back at February 1994, when the movies in theaters were The Legend of Drunken Master, The Air Up There, Blink, Spanking the Monkey, and of course, our movie for today, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, which earned $107.2 million on an $11 million budget.
Nice. And please, don't be a Zaher and spoil this movie for yourself if you haven't seen it yet. Please, please, do not ruin this movie for you because it is a masterpiece. So if you haven't seen the movie, please press pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
Masterpiece. So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "He's the best there is. Actually, he's the only one there is."
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of looking into it, but there is actually there are real life pet detectives. So I mean, he's not exactly the only one there is.
Did you look into the history of pet detection, though?
No, I didn't.
I'm wondering whether it's an industry that came into existence because of this movie, that someone said, hey, there's a niche in the market that that is untapped. Maybe I should capitalize on that. People know what a pet detective is now.
I don't know. Maybe we can pick this back up at the end while we're talking. I'll do a little bit of on-the-cuff research.
But in the meantime, that tagline may not be the best description of this movie, so let's go to Colin and do a 60-second synopsis.
All right, here we go. Is there a moose on the loose? Has a cat got your tongue? Are you stuck on a wild goose chase? If you are the victim of animal-based criminal activity, there's only one man for the job. Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. When the Miami Dolphins' aquatic mascot Snowflake is mysteriously kidnapped, Ace is on the case. But there's more to this marine-based mystery than meets the eye, as Ace uncovers a murderous plot against the Dolphins' star quarterback Dan Marino. Will Ace be able to stop Marino's would-be assassin and recover Snowflake in time for both of them to make it to the Super Bowl? Let's find out today on another episode of I Used to Like This One. And that is your 60-second synopsis.
Outstanding. You had fun with those puns, didn't you?
I was like, I actually had to Google, what are animal-based idioms?
Yeah, this is one of those movies that came out while I was in junior high. And, I mean, I just remember the absolute stupid phenomenon everything in this movie was when it came to quotes and everything. Like, we were talking about this back on our Austin Powers episode, that there were so many things that came out of that, and you were talking about how it's the future ones, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. But this was one that is just, you could not go anywhere without people already thening you, or,
yeah,
or you know,
Lahoozaherring you.
Lahoozaher, or talking out of their butts. What's your experience with Ace Ventura?
I'm trying to remember, in 1994, I would have been like 9 years old, 9 or 10 years old. And I just remember this movie being like the apex of everything that was comedy at the time.
Yeah.
All that stuff you talked about. I remember like being in class and people talking with their butts and like doing the Lahoozaher and all that, and just watching it and finding Jim Carrey so funny.
Yeah.
Is kind of my main memory. Like, I think this movie was my introduction to Jim Carrey.
I think it was everybody's introduction to him, because it was like, where did this guy come from? Oh, he's on In Living Color. Like, that's kind of, oh, yeah, he's the white guy on In Living Color, is kind of all anyone knew Jim Carrey from before this, I think.
Was this his first movie? Or is
it,
I thought Dumb and Dumber and the Mask were first. Or am I
wrong? No. It's not his first movie. I'll get into that with some of his credits, but it's like it is the movie that made him. Because it was after this that The Mask came out.
Okay.
And then it was Dumb and Dumber and Liar Liar and all those sort of things.
Yeah.
So
I also feel like this movie defined a lot of, well, I kind of said that already, but it like defined a lot of what people thought was funny. Like even when I was watching the movie, just that physical comedy, like all those mannerisms and everything in the face. I had one of my best friends in high school, I feel like he's one of the funniest people I know. But his style of comedy when we were high school, junior high, was exactly this Jim Carrey over the top. And I was just watching this movie and remembering those times and how funny it was. And that scene, we'll talk about it later probably, but that scene when he's walking to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And just all the needless, like, skirting across the wall and the...
Yeah,
So good. I love it.
And so this friend of yours, he was one that, like, pulled a lot of faces and stuff, too, then?
Yeah, I remember, I remember one time specifically, there was a school dance, and, like, the Macarena came on, and of course there's, like, a dance to the Macarena that people usually do, but he did this, like, full-on, like... I don't know. It was like the Elaine dance from Seinfeld, but like cranked to 11 with like that Jim Carrey flair. And I don't think I've ever laughed so hard in my entire life.
Nice. Well, alrighty then. Let's jump into Ace Ventura: Pet Detective. It's directed by Tom Shajek, who was also a director on Liar Liar, Patch Adams, The Nutty Professor, Bruce, and Evan Almighty. It's produced by James G. Robinson, who was a producer on Ace Ventura 2, the Ace Ventura cartoon, and a direct-to-video movie called Pet Detective Junior.
Yeah, I read about that movie, which it's about Ace Ventura's son.
Okay, see, I assumed it was him as a kid.
No, well, from what I had found it when I was looking for reviews, because it came up on the Google Play Store. It came out in 2009, and... Yeah, from what I remember, it said that it's Ace Ventura's son, and he's, like, looking to... His mother gets caught up in some... is wrongfully accused of some crime, and so he's trying to solve it and break out of jail.
Oh, okay.
But funny enough, I was also reading in my research that...
Hey, everybody. Editing Sean here. I just wanted to let you know that we are about to have a massive spoiler drop for the show WandaVision right now. So, in case you are a WandaVision watcher, but you are behind on it, this episode has been out for a while, but just in case, I figured you need a spoiler warning, and this is your opportunity to skip past that. So if you skip forward exactly 1 minute, you will be in the clear, and that time starts now.
They're planning to make an Ace Ventura 3.
Of course.
With Evan Peters, who played Quicksilver in the X-Men movies and is currently kind of reprising that role on WandaVision.
Kind of.
Oh, shit. That's a spoiler.
That one's a big spoiler.
Maybe let's just... Actually, you know what? Let's just cut that out. He's Quicksilver in X-Men, and that's basically what I know him from.
He's also Kick-Ass's buddy. Because that's the thing, is Kick-Ass is one of the Quicksilvers, whereas...
Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Yeah, he's the one in the Avengers universe. I was trying to describe this to my girlfriend, for the same reason that we just recently edited out of the show. So I was trying to explain why their crossover is in, Kick-Ass, because one of them plays Kick-Ass, one of them plays Ass-Kick.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyways, there's rumors that Evan Peters is going to be starring in an Ace Ventura 3, okay, and he will be in the role of Ace Ventura's son.
Okay. Ace Ventura just doesn't seem right without Jim Carrey. Yeah.
It kind of reminded me of like those, I don't know, anytime I see these weird offshoot movies, but it reminded me of how you're talking when we did A Christmas Story, there's like A Christmas Story 2 and all these other direct-to-DVD movies that you never hear about. You're just kind of like, why did this, like, who needed to make this so badly?
Yeah, because Pet Detective Junior, the way you just described it, I mean, one, it sounds kind of like Encyclopedia Brown to me, or like a Hardy Boys or something like that. But on top of that, I wonder where it falls with Son of the Mask.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Like, I wonder if they came out at very similar times. Like, I wonder what the dates actually were on them. But this James G. Robinson guy also is a producer on Young Guns 1 and 2, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Joanna Man, and everything Exorcist from number 3 on, like including the series. It's written by Jack Bernstein, who must be an expert on cops or detectives, because nearly all his credits have something to do with that genre. Like, he's a writer on Monk, Silk Stockings, NCIS, like a lot of TV, and of course he gets the character credits on any future Ace Ventura stuff. It's also written by Tom Shadyac, the director, who has only one other credit on Nutty Professor, and I'm not sure why he doesn't even get the based on credits for any of the other Ace Ventura stuff, which is also the same for the third writer on the film, Jim Carrey, who, as I mentioned, is from In Living Color, and he has comic relief stuff. We open the movie on a close-up of shoes that are walking down the street. We zoom out to see a man dressed in a courier uniform similar to a UPS uniform, which, interestingly, if you turn every letter in this logo upside down, because it's HDS is who he works for, if you turn it all upside down, you get UPS, because it's a lowercase h in HDS. So it's like, it's a very on-the-nose spoof of the UPS company.
That's interesting.
This is our hero for the movie, Ace Ventura, played by Jim Carrey. Like, really, this is the movie that, as I mentioned before, absolutely launched him into superstardom, because before this, he was on In Living Color. But his early career is very interesting. Like, his first movie is in 1981. Like, he goes all the way back to that, and it's a movie called Rubberface, and he's the lead of it. He was also in Peggy Sue Got Married, The Deadpool, and Pink Cadillac, which are Clint Eastwood movies. He was in Earth Girls Are Easy, High Strung, Doing Time on Maple Drive, which looks like it was a serious movie about suicide and stuff. And so, like, that's what he did before Ace Ventura. And then after Ace Ventura, everyone knows Jim Carrey.
And does he have, like, is he, like, in these Clint Eastwood movies, is he just, like, I don't know, guy at the restaurant, or does he have, like, a real part?
I don't remember exactly. One of them, I believe, was Elvis Presley impersonator.
Oh, okay, that lines up.
Yeah, I don't remember what the other one was, but interestingly, I read that Ace could have been played by Rick Moranis, Judd Nelson, Alan Rickman, Adam Sandler, Rob Schneider, or Whoopi Goldberg. They toyed with making Ace Alice instead.
Sorry, I'm just trying to imagine what an Alan Rickman Ace Ventura looks like.
Right?
Like,
which of his other characters do you draw from? Do you draw from Galaxy Quest, or do you look at, like, Hans Gruber or Professor Snape? Like,
you know, like, yeah. I'm not seeing it. I honestly can't imagine, even with, like, listening, I can't imagine, like, the closest one I honestly think would be either Whoopi Goldberg or maybe Rob Schneider, but still.
Well, Adam Sandler, too.
Oh, yeah, Adam Sandler, yeah. I can't, it's hard to imagine anybody but Jim Carrey being Ace Ventura.
Well, if it was Alan Rickman, I hope that he would have been finding owls, though.
Yeah.
Oh.
I feel like if it's Alan Rickman, it's like, it has to be serious. It couldn't be that over the top.
Yeah.
How would that be possible? I don't know. Maybe I haven't seen enough Alan Rickman movies.
It's a very subdued alrighty then.
Yeah. La who Zaher.
So Ace is walking down the street carrying a package that is labeled fragile glass and treating the package with zero respect, hitting it against stuff, dropping it, doing cartwheels on it, and getting it repeatedly slammed in an elevator door that closes with so much force. So much. Yeah, I was gonna
say, that's a safety hazard for small children.
He gets to the floor he's delivering to, plays soccer with the package until he gets to a door, picks it up, dusts it off, and knocks. And the door is grumpily answered by someone I know from Raising Arizona, ex-boxer and kickboxer Randall Tex Cobb. As a boxer, he had a 43-7 career, with 36 of those being KOs. But yeah, he says, HDS, sir. and how are you doing today? Alrighty then. I kept an alrighty then tally. He actually only does say it 4 times in this movie. It must have felt like more just because I heard it 1.5 million times.
Yes.
When I was with my friends at school.
Yeah, that seems light. But it's also, I feel like he says it in really key scenes.
Yeah.
So that they're the scenes that you would see most often, so it probably does seem more in retrospect. But your point is probably more the reality of just that's all people talk.
Yeah.
Because I felt the same thing about the La Who's the Her thing. I thought that was like every 2 minutes.
Yeah. Well, and even to your point, though, I do remember a lot of them being in pivotal scenes, but this is one, like, one of the four is this one, and he just throws it away, because it's like, how are you doing today? Alrighty then. Yeah. HDS, sir, you know, like, this one is a throwaway already then. So there's only 3 meaty, meaty, hearty alrighty thens in this movie. So whatever is in this box definitely sounds broken, so Ace gives him some insurance forms to sign and initial, while he takes a moment to pet this guy's dog. Ace stands up again, tells the gruff man that he'll handle the rest, and he leaves. And now we watch as Ace is speed walking down the sidewalk. HDS coming through! I've got a package, people! In his apartment, we see the gruff man telling his dog to get away from the door. He goes over to grab the dog, but it's a stuffed animal, with a note around its neck saying, "You've been had by Ace Ventura Pet Detective." I've never been able to wrap my mind around the position of this stuffed dog and how the door manages to close with it where it's standing.
Oh yeah.
Because the dog is like set up right behind the center of the door.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Because the door would have hit the dog.
Yeah. It would have dragged it back out into the hallway. Like, he would have had to have like placed this dog actually by the crack of the door for it to even have been remotely possible.
Yeah. Or like to the side or something like that. Production error, these people.
I need to get on the phone, yeah. Back on the street, we see Ace again. The real dog is inside his shirt. In every game, there has to be a winner and a Zaher. He gets it to his car, offers the dog some kibble that is in the ashtray, and his car doesn't start. No worries, it's just flooded. Happens all the time. We'll just give it a minute and then smash. Gruff Man has caught up with Ace and is smashing his car with a baseball bat. And instead of waiting, let's try restarting now. And it gets started and we get, it's alive! And he floors it. The gruff man grabs onto the back through the busted out rear window. I keep calling him Gruff Man because that is his actual credited name in the in the movie. His Tex Cobb plays Gruff Man. The dog and Ace are biting his hands, and it gets him to loosen his grip, and Ace shakes him off. The dog is successfully rescued, and he returns the dog to the very busty owner. I've always wondered about this moment here where she says, "Did you miss mommy?" And the dog buries its face right into her cleavage, and she says, "Oh, yes, you did." Is there a backstory there?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like that was just an excuse to have that, like, to put boobs in the movie.
Yeah, but it's just the, "Oh, yes, you did" line is after the dog starts rooting around in that cleavage. Like, it's...
Are you suggesting some form of bestiality is occurring, or...
I'm just wondering, yeah. Like, I feel like they must have had to put a treat down there to get the dog to respond, but I'm just wondering, like, did the dog jump its cue?
Yeah.
And now it forever looks like it's some sort of Catherine the Great story going on there or something. She's the one with the horse, isn't she?
No, that's Catherine the Great, yeah.
Yeah, oh, okay, yeah. She asks Ace how she can repay him, and he's listing off things like his car suffered damages, he put premium gas in because it's a high-powered machine, and she counters with, "How about I take your pants off? Let me think about that? Sure." So, pretty poor business model, Ace. No wonder you're in trouble with the landlord. You can't pay rent with blowjobs. Because if you could, I'd be much wealthier and have very chapped lips.
The funny thing watching this scene is I don't think I ever realized what was happening here.
Yeah.
Until literally this watch. I probably haven't watched this movie in close to like probably since I was in high school or junior high, and I don't think I picked up on what exactly was going on.
Well, and when he's swinging from the door frame as well, his waist comes up above the camera, and you can actually see that his pants are still on. So it's like, yeah. You never actually took his pants off. So this line makes even less sense to me as a child.
Yeah.
So we now cut to night and what the mystery of this movie centers around. With sinister music to match, we watch as a group of people in shadows, including one with a very distinctive-looking ring, drug and abduct a dolphin with a very clear shot of the hand with the ring getting hit against the side of the tank by the thrashing tail of this dolphin. A lot of focus on that ring. So I am glad that they did make sure that they set up that, okay, this is going to be the biggest plot point. We have to make sure that we do show it so that it doesn't come out of nowhere. But that hand, like knowing how this movie ends, that is a very masculine looking hand.
Yeah.
Einhorn does not have hands like that. So I don't know. I mean, that's jumping way ahead, but still.
But yeah, there's a, you know, I'll save it for later, but I agree with your point.
Yeah. Back to Ace, who is arriving home with a grocery bag full of pet food and has to sneak past his landlord's window. So he uses a sight gag I've always loved, where he pulls the palm frond off of a tree, walks past, and then drops his frond in a pile of progressively browning leaves. I love the sight gag. This is obviously what he does literally every day.
Yeah.
He gets to his apartment door, but it turns out that he wasn't sneaky enough because his landlord, Mr. Shickadance, catches up to him. I read that this is actually named for an actual landlord that Jim Carrey had in Toronto, the Shickadance. Like, it's such a weird name, but he actually had a landlord that had a very similar name, but not quite.
Okay.
I think it was something a little bit more like Eastern European was what this guy's name was. It was more like,
yeah,
Shickadance or something.
And who is that actor? I've seen him in a lot of stuff.
Do you watch Breaking Bad? That might be what you know him most as. He's the bell guy in Breaking Bad. I actually forgot to write that guy down because I feel like Mr. Shickadance is such a small character. Yeah, I didn't jot him down, but that's one thing I remember him most from is Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I just remember he's one of those guys who's like a career like character actor.
Yeah.
Like he's never a big role, but he's always there as like basically this character. Like he's always I think he was born to play a landlord or like a manager or something like that.
Pawn shop owner.
Yeah.
So Ace is late on the rent because he's just out there getting blowjobs instead of money. But Ace has a long-term financial goal. He is going to catch a rare albino pigeon and claim the $25,000 reward. Isn't an albino pigeon just a dove?
I mean, yeah.
I've always heard that pigeons are like the same family as the dove. Like, aren't they like one of the most closely related birds, the dove and the pigeon? Like,
yeah,
how can you tell the difference between an albino pigeon and a dove? I'm sure some ornithologist out there can, like, that's the bird one, I think, is ornithologist. They can write in and tell us that what the difference is. But
I was gonna say, I feel like the albino pigeon might have red eyes.
Oh,
that's also a trait of like albinism.
Albino. Yeah,
I don't know what you call it.
No, albinism, that's the word, albinism. Sure.
Yeah.
The landlord is also complaining about animal noises coming from Ace's place. He's not supposed to have pets. He says he has no pets, and his bag of pet food is just for fiber in his own diet. Come on in, snoop around. So he starts unlocking his door with some very intentional rattling of his keys in the lock, and he opens the door. I've also always loved that moment, the fact that you realize that he is actually doing something smart. Like, it's kind of like I said back in Austin Powers again, is the fact that I do appreciate that as stupid as the character is, he is also smart and really good at his job.
Yeah.
Like, there is a craftiness to Ace Ventura, and this is one of those moments, the way he rattles the keys in a certain pattern, and it's, you know, he's trained all the animals inside to hide at the sound of these keys.
Yeah, I think that's, like, the more we watch these movies, and I kind of dissect them a little bit, I think that's, like, a really important trait, especially in comedy main characters.
Yeah.
If they're gonna be really over the top, they either need to be completely, like, crap at their job, kind of like get smart.
Yeah.
Or they need to be like exceedingly competent in their job with like crap scenarios.
Yeah. So he lets the landlord poke around a bit, and there's no animals to be seen. He leaves with some departing words of, "Don't let me catch you with animals, and get me my rent." Ace slams the door and then calls out, "Come to me, my animal friends," and the room is suddenly filled with a menagerie of animals that were all hidden in cupboards, and the toilet, and a squirrel comes out of a peanut can, and a collection of animals so diverse that Stephanie from Short Circuit would lose her fucking mind. Because she doesn't even have this variety of animals. She does have a skunk. I still don't understand that. We now leave Ace and go instead to a boardroom at the Miami Dolphins Stadium, where they are discussing the abduction of Snowflake the Dolphin, the team mascot. And I think the Dolphins are such a big part of this movie, we need to launch this off as our spot for Sponsorship Corner.
There you go.
So always on the lookout for product placements, this is definitely not the biggest I've ever seen, but still not too shabby. Ace Ventura Pet Detective is brought to you by the Miami Dolphins, the NFL, Nine Lives and IM's Cat Food, Milkbone, Planters Peanuts, DARE, Drug Abuse Resistance Education, Cannibal Corpse, Chevrolet and Mercedes-Benz, Nike, Budweiser, Isotoner, Wilson, Gatorade, Shula's Steakhouse, and Sony. Plus the mascot Ace fights at the end. I can't tell if it's officially a Philadelphia Eagles eagle, or just a knockoff that doesn't look quite right. So maybe it's also sponsored by the Philadelphia Eagles. And you can also see a picture of Batman and Robin on Ace Ventura's mantelpiece at one point, which is ironic with Jim Carrey's future role in Horny Batman 1. And a special shout out to the fictional HDS Courier Company. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. So at the Dolphins Stadium, we meet Roger Pedactor, who is played by Troy Evans. He was in 129 episodes of ER, 51 episodes of Bosch. He was in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Phenomenon, Teen Wolf, Cuffs, and a couple connections to our show, Demolition Man and It Runs in the Family, which was one of the Christmas Story sequels that Colin mentioned. We also meet Melissa Robinson, who is played by Courtney Cox from Masters of the Universe, Cocoon the Return, Zoom, Bedtime Stories, Cougar Town, but really best known for her role in as Gale Weathers in all four Scream movies or as Monica Geller on Friends, and famously got her start as the fan that gets pulled out of the audience in the Bruce Springsteen video Dancing in the Dark. I did read that for the role of Melissa, Carrie Ann Moss, Lauren Holly, and Tay Leone were also considered, which is funny because Lauren Holly does appear with Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber, and Tay Leone with him in Fun with Dick and Jane.
Yeah.
But yeah, those were all also possibilities for this character.
Yeah, I can for sure see that. Especially, for whatever reason, I can especially see Tay Leone in.
Yeah.
And that, I don't know if it's because we just saw her in Bad Boys, but
yeah, maybe.
She just fits that kind of mold of like the 90s actress that role is.
Yeah, it's like the 90s actresses were either like serious in the way that someone like Gillian Anderson was,
mm-hmm.
or they were funny in the way that Tay Leone was, you know, or whatever, or you know.
Yeah.
So the two of these people are being berated by the team owner, or is he just a GM? I couldn't quite tell whether he was the owner or the GM.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But he's yelling at them about getting the fish back before the press catches wind of the abduction. Plus, you know how superstitious players are, to which we see Roger hide his rabbit's foot keychain. They leave this meeting having no idea where to start. They could check with animal rights groups, but that's when the receptionist Martha suggests hiring a pet detective. He was very professional and used a highly sophisticated scientific process. And then, of course, we get the hilarious cut to Ace cooing like a pigeon out on a ledge trying to catch his albino payday. He doesn't quite succeed and ends up falling off the ledge and landing on his back in a dumpster with his pager going off. He'd be dead. That's one of the only stunts that I don't believe in the movie. That and catching the bullet in the mouth. Other than that, like, there's still a lot of stuff that is fairly set in reality for as stupid as Ace Ventura is.
Yeah.
But he falls off like three stories into a dumpster. He'd be dead.
Well, I mean, we don't know what's in that dumpster.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It could be... He could.
What if somebody had just thrown out... What if somebody just moved out and threw, like, three mattresses in there?
The old dumpster behind the foam rubber factory.
What luck.
So, the Dolphins organization has taken Martha's advice and contacted him. So he cruises to the stadium, driving like a maniac, head out the window because his windshield is still smashed up, and slides his car into a parallel park like a glove.
So good. Love it.
Maybe that's why it feels like there's more Lahoozahers in this movie, because when he says something like a glove, like, it's in the same family.
Mm-hmm. It's almost weird because it's kind of a character tick that I wonder if he was just trying to work in, but there's like a gap where he kind of doesn't do any for a long time, considering he's a writer on it. A lot of that kind of stuff is probably improv.
Yeah.
So
maybe the more serious stuff was the stuff that was filmed earlier in the process, and it was later on that he started just pushing it further and further. And so, so his wackiest performances were towards the end of production. He's just getting out of control. So Ace meets Melissa in her office, where she shows footage of Snowflake doing his halftime trick. The whole time Ace is eating sunflower seeds.
So gross.
Just crunching them up and putting them on her desk. Would you like an ashtray? I don't smoke. Disgusting habit. But yeah. Oh, I don't understand the choice of the sunflower seeds. Like, it's just one of those choices that just seems so much, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah. I love when they pan over to him and it's like, not only does he have his nasty little pile of shells, but you can see in his teeth just all these black chunks.
Yeah, you gotta wonder how long Jim Carrey had to rinse out his mouth after doing that scene, because, like, he just crunches them up so small that he's probably picking sunflower chunks out of his teeth for days.
Yeah.
So it's time to see the tank, which has been drained. On the way, so they're trying to keep this hidden from the press, but they've drained the tank. You know, that doesn't seem like the smartest idea, but on the way, Ace gets a chance to meet Roger. He says if he's walking funny, it's because he's had a dozen reporters up his ass wanting to see Snowflake. They're struggling to keep the news of the abduction under wraps. Roger tells Ace he came highly recommended by Martha. Oh yeah, the bitch! But then he shows that he's smart, and he says, Pekingese, lost in the park, and then climbs into the tank and does some Star Trek impressions because Jim Carrey. The reporters are coming, and Melissa is begging for him to get out of the tank. Now, I watched this on Netflix, but I remember there being a scene here.
Oh, really?
But the version I watched didn't have it, unless it's a deleted scene that I know. But I could have sworn that there was a scene here where he hops out of the tank and pretends to be a dolphin trainer with, like, some sort of, like, German accent, very flamboyant with the German accent. And I swear this was in the movie. But maybe it's just I know a deleted scene so well that I've just retconned it into this.
Yeah, we should look it up on YouTube and then throw it on, see if we can find it, throw it up on the Facebook page.
Yeah, if I can find it, I'll put it on our social medias for sure.
Because now that you mention it, I feel like I kind of remember that, but I'm not sure. I wonder if there was something like Nazi-ish about it or like racist about it that Netflix might have removed it.
Yeah, but somehow something that is very transphobic at one point has made the cut. So,
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, if I can find it, I'll throw it up. But whether I'm remembering wrong or not, we move on to Ace looking through the pool's filter, where he finds a very unusual amber stone. And so he has a clue. He decides to go see if maybe he can team up with the real police. He goes to the police station and gets mocked by some of the cops, like Sergeant Aguado, who is played by John Capodice. He has 156 credits. Nothing jumped out at me, except apparently he was in one of the movies we've covered, The Secret of My Success. I don't remember him in Secret of My Success, but apparently he was in that one. And so Aguado does stuff like stepping on a cockroach and asks Ace how he's going to solve this, to which Ace retorts with, and Aguado has a small dick joke. And then...
I love the line when he's like, what did he say? He says something about, like, he would burn calories porking his wife or something like that.
Yeah, porking his wife. Yeah. Yeah. After laying a verbal smackdown, Ace goes to visit his buddy Emilio, who is played by famous rapper Tone Loc, who for movies was in Heat, Blank Check, Posse, Poetic Justice, and voice work in movies like Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest, and Titan A.E. Okay, sidebar for a sec. Is Funky Cold Medina about roofies?
The Funky Cold Medina. I don't know. Let's check out. Let's do a lyrics check here.
Or am I thinking of... No, Wild Thing is... There's one of his songs is very date rapey. Maybe that's Wild Thing.
Oh yeah, yeah. No. This is, yeah. Here's the lyrics. So this brother told me a secret on how to get more chicks. Put a little Medina in your glass, and the girls will come real quick.
It's better
than any alcohol or aphrodisiac. A couple sips of this love potion, and she'll be on your lap.
Yeah.
But I mean, it sounds more like he's saying, like, you as the man take it and it will attract the woman to you. I don't necessarily know that he's like, I don't know that he's roofieing anyone.
It could be more like a Spanish fly idea.
Yeah, it's more like Sex Panther, you know, like 60% of the time it works every time type deal.
I've just always thought that about the lyrics is like, yeah. Not cool, Tone Loc. Not cool. You're slipping something into their drinks. No matter what it is, not cool, Tone Loc. Consent. So Ace uses Emilio to get information, which he does by using his ass to talk, as we've mentioned before. He finds out that Sergeant Aguado, one of the cops he despises most, is in charge of the Snowflake case. Panicking because his boss, Lieutenant Einhorn, is on her way up, and Ace won't let the substandard information Emilio has provided stand, and because he's still talking with his ass, Emilio spills the beans about all the progress made in the case. Maybe progress is the wrong word, more like the half-ass boxes that have been checked is kind of how it sounds. Okay, yeah, they checked with animal rights groups. There we go. That's the end of Aguado's investigation at this point. And as soon as all the information is passed on, holy testicle Tuesday, enter Lieutenant Lois Einhorn, played by Sean Young, who was in Dune, Wall Street, Stripes, but I know her best from Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. Einhorn is actually German for unicorn, the most phallic of mythological creatures.
It's kind of funny that the more I watch it and as we're going through it, I realize that they make a lot of, like, male references towards Einhorn even before the big reveal.
Yeah.
But she could not look more feminine.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. But yeah, like, it starts right here with the Holy Testicle Tuesday. Like, I know at one point Einhorn's desk has two apples and a banana strategically placed on it. Or there's the dog in Roger's apartment that barks at Einhorn and its dogs can sense evil. Like, there are a lot of hints when you know to look for them in this movie that actually lead to the big reveal at the end. But she's angry that Ace is in her precinct and tells him to yield to the experts on this one. We'll find the porpoise. So Ace responds with, "Phew, I was worried. Except what's missing isn't a porpoise, but a dolphin," and proceeds to drop a major biology lesson on them. Boom! So again, you know, the idiot is smart, which is great. Like, he might have gone to college for biology and done really well. So Ace, undeterred, continues on his investigation. He decides to go see his buddy Woodstock, who is in the basement of some venue hosting a Cannibal Corpse concert. Why is he there? Like, what is Woodstock's connection to this place?
Yeah, I don't know. That whole scene seems so weird to me. It was almost like it was just an ad for Cannibal Corpse.
In a way, yeah. It also reminded me of the one character in UHF, where it's kind of the techie guy.
Yeah.
Where it's like, why is this guy here? He's just a weird character to have. And, like, they look similar, too.
Yeah.
But we have the password to get into Woodstock's private room. New England clam chowder. Is that the red or the white? I can never remember that. White? And to this day, this is the only reason why I know the difference between clam chowders is because of this movie. I can always remember that New England clam chowder is white. Well, Woodstock is a hacker and a bit of an environmentalist because he is currently hacking the radar of a whaling fleet that he's sending new coordinates to them to go to the middle of nowhere. Woodstock calls Ace St. Francis, which I found interesting. That's his nickname for Ace. St. Francis of Assisi is the patron saint of animals. And you can actually, at one point in this movie, see a St. Francis statue when they go to the Shady Oaks Mental Institution.
Okay.
Yeah, you can see St. Francis in the background. So I just thought, wow, that's actually some very clever writing.
Yeah, I like that.
You know, it's like when you found out in Harry Potter that Remus Lupin is just another way of saying wolf. You know, and you thought that was clever, but you were a kid when you read that. I mean, this is some very, very clever writing, I thought. But Ace gives Woodstock a job to do. Find someone in town that may have recently purchased enough aquarium equipment to house a dolphin. This is very little challenge for Woodstock, who quickly finds out that the local rich guy and rare fish collector, Ron Camp, has just made such a purchase. And wouldn't you know it, the very next night he's throwing an I'm the richest guy in the universe party. And fortunately, Ron Camp is also a big financial backer of the Miami Dolphins, so using Melissa as a connection, Ace secures an invitation to the party. And they arrive at the mansion amid pretentious violins playing. So it must be a super fancy party if we've got violin music going. Melissa introduces Ace to Ron Camp as Ace. Tom Ace, lawyer. Ron Camp is played by Udo Kier, who we talked about back in Blade. But I did a little bit more deep diving into him. He's a pretty interesting cat. Like, okay, so he was born October 14th, 1944 in Cologne, Germany. So look at the dates and the location. 44, Cologne, Germany. Minutes after he was born, the hospital he was in was bombed.
Wow.
So he and his mother were found alive in the rubble, but he actually never knew his father. So he's got like 269 credits in a wide range of movies, Blade, Armageddon, Downsizing, The Puppet Master. But about a quarter of his movies are foreign, and they're in German, French, and Hungarian. So it's like, how many languages does this guy know? Like here's one of his French credits I found for a movie from a 1976 called Spermula! !
Oh my gosh.
It's described as a notorious secret society known as Spermula plans to return from the future and conquer Earth by neutering the male population. So, like, it's such a weird range of movies. He was also working on a movie called Dimension. It was a project similar to Boyhood, where, like, the actors film some new stuff every year so that the actors age naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But unlike Boyhood, this took place over 30 years.
Wow.
The project was scrapped a few years ago, but it was going to be released in 2024. Like, this is a movie he had been working on since 94.
Why did they scrap it?
I don't know. I have no idea. But yeah, like, when we did Blade, I did not mention much about Udo Kier. I'm like, yeah, he's that guy from Ace Ventura. But man, like, this guy, I found him fascinating. So anyway, with a new cover intact, Tom Ace starts improvising. He's made a lucrative career out of food poisoning cases. And how is everyone feeling tonight? Excuse me a moment. So So in a private conversation, Melissa is worried about Ace embarrassing her, but he tells her to keep Ron occupied while he works his magic. And he continues to pretend to check the hors d'oeuvres and later approaches Ron asking where the bathroom is. I think it's the pâté. So he locks himself in the bathroom and the Mission Impossible theme starts playing and he sneaks out the window. And this is the moment that you were alluding to when you were talking about your friend, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Where he does a bunch of silly physical comedy in his sneakiness. And then when the song ends, he has found a giant tank of water. Some of the sight gags, though, that he does are really funny. Like,
yeah,
when he's like jumps over the railing and then he comes back. And then there's the point where it looks like he's hanging on to the door frame to swing it open.
Yeah. The one that's probably my favorite is that one where he does the really pronounced, like, butt lean back.
Yeah.
And then pulls himself to jump over the railing. Yeah. It's just so unnecessary.
He's like Powdered Toast Man in Ren and Stimpy. I think that's how he launches himself out as he sticks his butt way out. No, you don't know Ren and Stimpy?
No, I don't. No, okay. Sorry, man. I know who they are, but I've never watched the show.
So he climbs to the top of the tank and comes out on a narrow bridge over the tank. This is like such a weird design choice if you're going to be keeping a giant fish or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, we find out it's a fish. But yeah, just a tiny little narrow bridge over the tank. Like, it almost looks like an extended ladder over the tank. Like, it just, you'd think you'd want to be able to see your giant animal.
Yeah,
you'd think there'd be a bleacher type situation.
I think that's just for like feeding,
maybe,
so you can walk over and toss the fish in the thing, or maybe make it do tricks.
But like, is this a temporary tank? Because like, if you're an exotic fish collector, like, there's not even glass on the outside of this tank.
Yeah,
like, you would not be able to watch your purchase because you've got this dangerous narrow bridge with a ladder leading up to it.
Yeah, I was trying to think about that, like, is it, you know how at, like, really big aquariums or whatever, they have these little pots where you can, like, go on top to, like, feed the fish?
Yeah.
But then it's, like, you know, down in the main hall where you'd have, like, the larger area where you'd see everything.
Yeah.
Floating around. I was kind of wondering if that was that sort of situation, but at the party they never, at least I don't remember them ever seeing, like, in the walls that, like, the walls are aquariums or whatever.
No!
So.
No, for this rare fish collector, yeah, I don't remember there being, there was one aquarium,
mm-hmm.
but, like, that's it, like, a big aquarium. Like, it wasn't anything that was super extravagant if this guy is a rare fish collector.
Yeah, because you would have expected at the point where Ace gets snatched by the shark or whatever it is, that if there was an aquarium in the walls, there for sure would have been a scene where you saw him floating by, like, kind of similar to like Bad Boys or whatever with the fight where they're like banging on the glass and stuff.
Up against the glass, yeah. Yep, well, that's exactly where we are. He's climbed up to the narrow bridge. He has a bucket of fish, and we get yummy from him. He holds up a fish while whistling and calling Snowflake, I've got a snack for you. But surprise, it's a shark, not Snowflake. And he falls into the water and is comically tossed around while screaming. And then we cut back to the mansion where we see a line has formed for the bathroom. Ron is asking Melissa if her friend is okay when the door to the bathroom opens and a soaking wet Ace with shredded pants comes out, looks at everyone staring back at him, and gives the classic line of, do not go in there.
Woo! So good.
I also love when he slaps his pocket and you get that geyser of water too.
Yeah.
So Ron is seeing them out, apologizing for the plumbing, and he'll look into it immediately. Be sure you do. If I'd been drinking out of the toilet, I could have died.
You know what I actually love is that so many, I think the more we go through it, I'm like, I think this is what has influenced my humor, is I love these like throwaway jokes,
mm-hmm.
that they're not really, they don't like punch you in the face, like you really have to listen to them.
Yeah,
like even the one with the food poisoning cases earlier, like you're talking about, it's like,
yeah
I probably would have only caught that on, I don't know, the fifth go around probably. Like, I definitely wouldn't have caught it on the first one.
Yeah.
And it's just, I love that type of comedy.
So he spots Ron's ring, which happens to have the same unusual amber stones like the one he found in Snowflake's tank. And although Melissa is pissed at Ace, he explains that in Snowflake's tank he found a rare triangular cut orange amber from a 1984 Dolphin AFC Championship ring. And cue the looking for the ring missing a gem montage, getting people to flip him off, chasing a guy on a track, eventually chloroforming him, whipping someone with a towel to get him to punch him in the forehead. You know, the usual. The only one in the montage I don't understand is the guy at the urinal. And Ace is looking at his penis.
Yeah.
He looks at Ace's and then follows him out of the bathroom prancing. Like, I don't understand if this is the football player being gay or mocking Ace for being gay.
I think it's the football player being gay. That's how I take it.
Yeah? Okay. The conclusion after this Aerosmith montage, no one is missing a gem on their ring. So he's lounging in Melissa's backyard, bummed out and picking little fights with her. She thinks it's possible his hunch could be wrong, but he knows it's the right ring. Her phone rings and she goes to answer it. So feeling bad for acting like an asshole just now, because he's got that whole bit about, what do you feed your dog?
Yeah.
Because he's miserable. That's how he acts out at her.
Yeah.
He feels bad for acting like an asshole. He goes to apologize, but she's just received some bad news. Roger Pedactor was found dead from an apparent suicide. So Ace and Melissa head to Roger's apartment. Ace takes a quick look around before Lieutenant Einhorn gets pissed that he's there and wants him to leave. And he says, "You're right. I wouldn't want someone pointing out all the mistakes I was making." And she throws down the challenge to him because you need something called evidence. But he schools them, though, because this is what he's good at. He is actually smart.
Yeah.
It was a murder. And Melissa is kind of impressed by him. When he, like, goes through his entire thing about the fact that you are sure this door was closed when you came into this apartment, because it is, like, triple pane soundproof glass, and we get the whole bit with him opening and closing the door while singing a high note. It feels like the in like that old Looney Tunes cartoon where Bugs Bunny is posing as a conductor and he holds his hand up for the opera singer, and that's what it makes me think of, is him holding this like one tenor note.
Yeah, I feel like I remember a lot of kids doing that too with that, with like our like sliding doors.
Yeah. So he and Melissa leave. Ace is still on the search for the ring, so they head to check the files for the receipts. While searching through the files, we get a pseudo-sentimental scene between the two of them. She wonders why he never wanted to be a real cop. He doesn't do humans. But then he tells a story about a dream he had, giving him a kinship with animals, because he's talking about this dog in the dream that was just gaining on him and gaining on him. And then he got bit in the back of the neck. And then when he woke up, he reached back and he felt the back of his neck. And then he breaks the tension by barking at Melissa. So the receipts, though, turn out to be in an incomplete. So this search was useless until he sees a team picture on the wall and says, "Who the hell is that? The picture he's been working off doesn't have this guy in it." Well, that's the kicker, Ray Finkel. He was added halfway through the season and notoriously missed the kick that lost them the big championship game in 1984. Well, it appears that we have a heaping load of motive. And just because Ace doesn't think Melissa should be alone tonight, we get a silly sex scene to "The Lion Sleeps Tonight" while all Ace's animals watch. And we get the line, of course, of three times, "I'm sorry, this has never happened before. I must be tired." And, oh, I'm ready again.
I bet that was a common line for people who are of a certain age in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. Next day, Ace heads to Collier County to search for Ray Finkel. He is definitely a hated person in town. Graffiti on the sign making it say, the home of Ray Stinkle. He gets to the childhood home of Ray Finkle, which is covered in graffiti as well. I felt like maybe you had something you wanted to say about Stinkle.
No, I love that. It's such a like stupid 5-year-old name calling thing, but it's so funny to me.
It's still effective. Yeah.
Yeah, it works on all levels.
So he knocks on Ray Finkle's childhood home door, which is answered with one of those sliding peepholes by Ray's dad. I'm looking for Ray Finkle. And the shotgun gets pulled. And a clean pair of shorts. So Ace claims to be a fan, and he lists off all of Finkel's accomplishments. This is an impressive bit of line delivery from Jim Carrey. That is a shit ton of memorization. Like, have you ever had one of those speeches in a play where you just have to list stats for like a minute straight? Oh my god. And he does it all in one breath, which makes it extra impressive.
Yeah.
No cuts. Oh, that would have been a rough piece of dialogue to memorize. But he says, "This is my Graceland, sir." Mrs. Finkel comes in and tells her husband to put the gun away. He's a fan of our boy. And she's not all there, we find out, claiming that Ray will be home any moment now, but Dad knows this isn't true. In fact, Ray has spent time in a mental institution, and Mrs. Finkel never accepted it. The hospital has been telling them to come pick up some stuff he left behind. So Ace gets to see Ray's bedroom featuring all his crazy obsession with Laces Out and Dan Marino. There's also a film of The Kick heard around the world. Ace realizes from all this in-your-face obsession that the next target after Snowflake and Roger is Dan Marino. So he phones Melissa to tell her they need to get protection for Dan Marino. Where is he now? I'll be there as soon as I can. Well, Dan Marino is filming a commercial for Isotoner gloves, but during filming, he gets abducted. But Ace shows up just as he sees Dan Marino forced into a truck, and it's car chase time, and the bad guy's shooting at Ace. And this is where he catches the bullet in his teeth, which, yeah, it's one of the only gags that I don't like.
Yeah, I mean, I remember thinking it was super funny as a kid, but it's definitely, it kind of reminds me of the scene in Dumber and Dumber where he like has the daydream where he rips the guy's heart out.
Yeah.
And then he does the like beating heart in the hand or whatever.
Yeah. But that at least is a dream.
Yeah. It's just funny, but you don't want to think about it too much.
Yeah. The bad guys end up getting away when Ace rolls his car, but it still works. Good for him. Well, now that Snowflake and Dan Marino are missing, Einhorn is getting absolutely harassed by the press. It's mostly a no comment at this time type situation, and she gives them the slip just to find Ace waiting in her office for her. She doesn't need this shit right now. When I get out of the bathroom, I want you gone. And he says, number one or number two? I just want to know how much time I have. So he tells her he's gone ahead and solved that pesky Snowflake Dan Marino kidnapping business. And so he fills her in on everything he's found out about Ray Finkel. And in a break from character, she says, good job, Ace. She never calls him Ace. And when she comes onto him, kissing on her desk with her gun digging into his hip, he resists her advances with a whoosh, down boy. Ultimately, she once again tells him to leave it to the professionals. And when they find Marino, they'll deliver the dolphin. And he counters with, when he finds Snowflake, he'll deliver Marino. Ah, oh, that's a power play right there, Ace.
Animals first.
Yeah. Ace calls Melissa, telling her he needs her to commit him to Shady Acres Mental Hospital. He's a master of disguise. So, dressed in Doc Martens and a tutu, he's pretending to be an ex-football player with a mental break. He's doing a bunch of hilarious shit, including the slow-motion replay scene, which was unplanned, and if you watch closely, you can see Courtney Cox trying to keep her shit together in this scene.
Oh, really?
Like, when he goes, let's see that again in instant replay. And he goes, does it all backwards. Like, you can see Courtney Cox trying not to crack. So during the tour, as they're passing the storage closet, Ace says at one point, halftime, and does a whistle sound and slams his head into a bench and pretends to fall asleep. Melissa tells the doctor he'll be fine like that by himself for 20 minutes. So when they leave, Ace breaks into the storage room, finds Ray's box of stuff, which contains a newspaper article about a missing hiker named Lois Einhorn. I should also mention that something else I noticed, like, on this watch for the first time is the fact that the doctor actually says, and that's a storage room. Like, as he's giving them the tour, he says, that's a storage room. And that's when he goes, halftime! Like, so it is, yeah, so it is actually just not an insane coincidence. It is actually something that
was planned.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
So, yeah, he breaks into Ray's box of stuff, which contains a newspaper article about a missing hiker named Lois Einhorn. What the fuck is going on now? So, Emilio, on a tip from Ace, is searching Einhorn's office for clues to find what the connection is, and he comes across a letter in her desk from Roger Pedactor, thanking her for the other night. Dun-dun-dun, the plot thickens. Ace is stumped. What's the connection between Finkel and Einhorn? He's exhausted. He's racking his brains. Finally, looking down at the picture of Ray Finkel with his dog's fur looking like long hair, he comes to the realization. Finkel is Einhorn. Einhorn is a man.
Okay, halftime.
Okay.
So this is my part about Finkel and the whole Einhorn and the reveal here. Like, that looks nothing like Einhorn. You know what I mean? Like, even with the, I don't understand how you get to that conclusion. It looks nothing. They're completely different people. Even if you tried to erase the mustache, maybe. Unless I'm missing something. I don't know. But this girl looks nothing like him.
Okay, so I am going to blow your fucking mind right now. Like, we're talking, think Saul from Coming to America and how floored Joel was to find out that that was Eddie Murphy.
Oh my god.
That picture is Sean Young with a mustache.
No!
It is. They made her up to look like a man, but that is Sean Young.
All right.
I paused it. I looked, and I'm like, I do not see it. But everything I read about it tells me that that is actually Sean Young in a mustache.
Wow.
I mean, maybe...
My mind is blown. I can, like, I did the same thing. I paused it, and I looked at it with the hair, and I was just like, it looks... more like Tom Selleck.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even know. It doesn't look... I even tried to, like, picture her eyes.
Yeah.
Like, mustache. And I don't see it at all.
Yeah. Well,
but
see...
That's crazy.
No, because I've always wondered the exact same thing. Like, I've always wondered how he comes to this conclusion. Because, yeah, I've always thought it looks nothing like her. And I remember it was probably, like, the first two or three times. I didn't even understand what was going on with the hair and why... all of it. I wondered how the connection was made, but yeah, I read that it is her, and yeah. I don't know. Maybe our social media will also need a picture of the comparison here for our, you know, listeners to weigh in.
Yeah. The other thing I don't understand is why did it take... he found the thing about the missing hiker.
Yeah.
In the box. Like, why... I don't understand why it took that to put the pieces together.
Well, that's the transphobia aspect. You don't think about the fact that, wait a minute, I mean, that's 1994 for you. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Like, is reassignment surgery something that was big in 94? It's probably far less cases as there are nowadays.
My one thought when I was watching the movie was like, why didn't he just Google search Lois Einhorn? And I was like, yeah, there probably wasn't a Google then.
But yes, then we also get one of the dated references in this movie. We get like a straight out spoof from The Crying Game of him, you know, him trying to get the taste of kissing a man out of his mouth and crying in the shower and everything like that. Like, straight up Crying Game spoof, including the song itself.
Yeah. That also brought me to another theory that I had about Roger Pedactor, and that, you know, I mean, and you'll see it later when Einhorn is revealed to the entire police department. Like, clearly she's just made a... she gets her, like, jollies off of being a man and, like, making out with other men or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if, like, I have a theory that maybe Roger Pedactor did commit suicide because he was just so upset at the fact of, like, finding out that he kissed a man.
Yeah. But there is the scream and the blood that he found on the underside of the banister. So, like, right, Ace did solve that case. Yeah. Like, he did solve it as a murder, but that's kind of dark. And with how borderline offensive the outcome of this movie is, it is kind of nice that at least they didn't go that far with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, this is far enough, I think. and then in the morning, he is chewing all the gum. Still cringing from his realization, oh, your gun is digging into my hip. And he decides to tail Einhorn. She leads him to a secret hideout on the water where he sees Dan Marino tied up. And we get some more silly Ace sneaking around while Einhorn monologues a little for Dan Marino about laces out. And then she kisses him before leaving. Yeah, because there's another one. Dan Marino later on has the same reaction as well when he finds out that he was kissed by a man.
Mm-hmm.
He does have that line of, do you have any more of that gum, Ace? And Ace is like, that's personal, Dan, and I ask you to stay out of my personal affairs or whatever it is that he says.
Yeah.
But while she's gone, Ace takes out all the thugs and goes to rescue Dan Marino. But oh shit! Einhorn comes back, and she's holding Ace at gunpoint, and she calls it in, saying that she's found Dan Marino, and the suspect for the kidnapping is Ace Ventura. And so Ace starts poking the bear a little, trying to get the clearly unstable Ray Finkel / Lois Einhorn to snap. And she screams, what do you know about pressure? And he says, well, I have kissed a man. And her instability increases when the TV starts playing the highlight of Ray Finkel's infamous losing kick. So seizing on the opportunity of distraction, Ace attacks Einhorn, and they get in a tussle. And while they are tussling, all the backup cops show up, and they have all their guns drawn on Ace. And we've got Einhorn is yelling at the cops, shoot him now! But then enter Melissa with Emilio, who have it worked out that she is pretending to hold him at gunpoint to protect Ace. And Ace is given an opportunity to start a wrap-up monologuing about the Finkel-Einhorn connection, about the fact that she killed Roger because he found out her secret, Mr. Winky. But I've never understood at all why Einhorn is just standing there twitching. Because, like, he tries to prove that he's right. He tries to pull off her wig. Nope, not a wig. Fake boobs, he rips off her shirt. No, they're real, but you can get that kind of job done over a weekend. And then, like, he tears off her skirt. And, like, the whole time she's just, like, standing there twitching. Like, it's like...
I don't know if you know... I did appreciate that she's, like... She's got the, like, tight leg crossed. To, like...
Yeah, she does. She definitely looks like she is trying to tuck it back. But, like, I don't know. It's just, like... She's acting like a character that is dazed in a video game, like just standing there. You can almost see the cartoon stars above her head as she's standing there.
She's like Mortal Kombat, like when you're exactly. at the finishing part of Mortal Kombat. Yeah. She's just...
So, but the cops that are on their standoff are losing patience. Well, it seems like it would be harder to find the time in her busy schedule to do away with Captain Winky. And so, yeah, this is where he pulls off her skirt. There's no penis. Uh-oh, was he wrong? And that's when his esteemed colleague, Dan Marino, points something out. And so it's either she's a man, or she's got the worst case of hemorrhoids I've ever seen! And cue the crying game music, and everyone starts spitting. So, is everybody's reaction, is this just because of intense transphobia? Or is this because, like, Lois Einhorn is super slutty? There's even a couple women cops that you can see that are spitting. Like, has she just, like, made out with everyone in the precinct?
That's how I took it. Like yeah. I said before, I took it that she kind of, like, for whatever reason, like, got her jollies off on like, deceiving these men or whatever into believing that... Because, I mean, she is a very attractive woman.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, Einhorn is now captured, Snowflake and Dan Marino have been rescued, and they whisk them back to the stadium by halftime.
Yeah. I mean, to go back, I would say that the scene itself is evidence of transphobia.
Yeah.
But the cops necessarily, I don't know that they're necessarily transphobic.
Okay. Yeah, that's a Lois Einhorn is a slut joke. Okay.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Well, they whisk them back to the stadium by halftime. Okay, so first off, would they rush Dan Marino back in time for the game? Like, I feel like there would need to be some sort of debrief. Or would they make an exception for the Dolphins' star quarterback.
I mean, it is the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And football is big business in the States.
Yeah. And it's like, you gotta get the home team quarterback if the Super Bowl is happening in Miami, and Miami is playing.
Yeah.
So
I feel like they would just debrief later. It's not even like he has that much to say. He was more just a pawn in all of it.
Yeah. Second, I feel like getting Snowflake back would be far more complicated, like involving special transport equipment and shit.
Mm-hmm.
But they managed to get Snowflake back and in his tank doing his trick at halftime. But like, I feel like even to transport a dolphin, you have to tranquilize it.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because it is a trained dolphin. So maybe it's used to being transported.
Maybe. You'd just think it would panic if it, in a car ride, that you would actually have to, like, medicate it slightly to...
Yeah.
You usually give an animal some sort of tranquilizer before putting them on a plane,
mm-hmm.
for example. You know, it's... I don't know. It seems like getting them back before the end of this game doesn't seem possible at all.
Yeah.
But either way, Dan Marino takes the field, and Ace and Melissa are on the sidelines when Ace spots the albino pigeon he's been looking for sitting on the Gatorade jug, and he's sneaking up on it, about to grab it, when the mascot from the opposing team waves it away, and pissed off at what the mascot has done, Ace shoves the mascot, who shoves him back, and then he just starts wailing on him just as the stadium announcers tell the crowd that Snowflake was rescued by lover of animals, Ace Ventura, who is then shown on the Jumbotron pummeling the eagle, which is just one of those moments that is still very funny to me. And then the end. And that is Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. So, Colin, on IMDb, it scored a 6.9 out of 10, has a Metascore of 37. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 49% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 57. But, Colin, those are just numbers. Like a bullet to the teeth, why don't you hit us with some reviews?
All right. So my reviews today come from the audience of Rotten Tomatoes, audience users of Rotten Tomatoes. The funny thing is, Ace Ventura, people on Rotten Tomatoes actually took a lot of time to write full-out reviews. And a lot of them took aim at the critics.
Okay.
For not giving it a higher rating. So I'm going to point out a couple of those.
It's so meta.
Yeah. Endoff L gave the movie 5 out of 5 stars and says, "This movie just shows how out of touch so-called critics are. Seriously, if you don't understand or like this kind of humor, you shouldn't be reviewing the movie. This is a central comedy from that time period. The fans love it. That's all that matters when it comes to Ace Ventura. Not what some stuffy, quote-unquote, critic thinks. Great movie. That said, if you watch it going in thinking, I've got to find out what the big deal is, of course you won't like it. But those of us who saw it cold back in the day were rolling in the aisles. There's just nothing like the character of Ace. Although, truth be told, those who loved Sellers' Pink Panther will no doubt recognize some of the same unwarranted confidence the two characters share. But critics? Go back to your art films. This one isn't for you, and there's nothing at all wrong with that."
It's been a while since I've seen the Pink Panther movies, but if I remember correctly, Inspector Clouseau is also an idiot. Like, mm-hmm. Much like Maxwell Smart or Frank Drebin from Naked Gun, like, I'm pretty sure Clouseau is an idiot and just, like, has dumb luck in solving these cases.
Yeah, he's more of a fool for sure.
Yeah, so that's the thing is, with what he just said there about the Pink Panther type humor, it's like, well, no, Ace Ventura is still very smart as a character.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't find it the best comparison. But anyway.
All right. Marty A. gave it 4.5 out of 5 stars and says, "Came across this rating as I was looking up something about this movie. Not only was this part of the beginning of Jim Carrey's amazing career, but it is one of the greatest comedies of all time. I always thought that the critics are rotten tomatoes." What? Oh, sorry. I have a bump on my screen that I thought was a period. I'm going to redo that.
Okay.
"I always thought that critics are rotten tomatoes were failed artists." Hold on. I'm going to redo that because his grammar is wrong. "I always thought that the critics of Rotten Tomatoes were failed artists who have forgotten what a movie is meant to do. Entertain people. I guess them giving this film 47% proves I was right."
Yeah, you're right, though. These critics really, or, well, quote, critics, really get into it.
Yeah, the last one is not, it's not aimed at the critics, but I thought it was funny because it's like a very earnest and almost philosophical take on the movie. So, Kurt C., 4 out of 5 stars. When this movie originally aired, I was in my 20s, and I laughed so hard I couldn't breathe. It has not aged well. Or I matured. Whatever the root cause, I can't watch it without feeling it's just dumb now. I tried watching with my young nephews, and they are too sophisticated to truly find it humorous. Sigh. Kinda bums me out. Kinda wish that we could hold on to some of that innocence that made fart jokes funny. Or at least maybe find a couple hours a month when Jim Carrey's brand of stupid silly still could make me laugh that hard again.
I can kind of get behind what that last guy is saying a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know whether it was my age that I found Jim Carrey that much funnier when I was younger. I don't know. I have always liked Jim Carrey, and this, of course, is just about, like it is for just about everyone else, my introduction to Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm.
I still find him funny, and I like the wackiness, but I do like that he's calmed down a bit, because I don't know whether I would like him as much if all his movies were this over the top with his characters, you know?
Yeah. I kind of agree with his sentiment, but more, I don't know, I do think there is something to the fact, like, we demand such a high bar and high quality from movies now, where I feel like, you know, a lot of movies that we've watched, I wouldn't say necessarily are high quality, but they're still really, really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And now I feel like it's almost like when people are making a movie, like, I almost feel like comedy doesn't work. Comedy movies seem to not work as well as they did in the 90s because it's like, they don't draw as much. You have to think too much about what the audience is going to think that it sometimes feels like they are playing it too safe. Yeah. Like they could be more over the top or more abrasive, but you don't know what's going to be offensive sometimes one day to the next, and you don't want to, like, it just seems it's hard to be really comedic when people are too scared.
Yeah, I can see that.
I don't want to go too far with that because obviously there are things that are offensive and shouldn't be made fun of.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like a lot of these movies that you watch, like even this movie, like, yeah, there is a big tone of transphobia, but it's still a lot of the other stuff, the over-the-topness of it and everything like that is still funny.
Yeah. Even the idea of the twist ending itself, it is a very, I don't know whether clever is the right word, but, you know, it is a surprising twist.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least it was the first time. And it may not be done in the most delicate of ways, which is part of the problem. But, yeah, I still like the idea of, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
This is something that you wouldn't have automatically thought of, especially when you look at that picture and that does not look like Sean Young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I know for the longest time I was scared for us to bring this movie. And that was my biggest thing about it, is knowing what the twist was. And with so much going on in the news over the last year where trans rights have become such a big thing, it's hard to watch a movie like this and know how to comment on it. Because on the one hand, I'm in the camp of trans people are people and all that sort of stuff. I don't think that there should be any exclusion. On the other hand, I still love this movie. So I don't know whether I can get on board with cancel culture and saying, oh, we have to boycott this movie and pretend it never existed. I think you have to look at it as, okay, there was a time in our past that this was not as frowned upon and it's not right anymore. But I don't think it was approached in a hateful way.
No.
You know?
Yeah, like, it's still, like, to me it's more of, like, the thing that's funny is the deception.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just that in this case the deception has the tinge of, like, the transgender aspect. But, no, I would agree with you. I think it's just hard to know, like, when it's appropriate sometimes to take the context of the time into consideration and when it's just like, no, yeah, bad is bad.
Yeah. I do also kind of find it funny to think about, I keep going back to Austin Powers, but when he punches out the woman and then it very obviously becomes a man. Like, would that have solved the problem of this movie? Is if once he rips off her skirt, all of a sudden it does not look like beautiful Sean Young?
That would have been hilarious, actually, I think.
Yeah.
If all of a sudden it's just clearly, like, a man with chest hair and, like...
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, for me, I can look at this movie and say it still gave me a lot of laughs, and that's everything outside of the twist as well. I still enjoyed the performance of it, and it brought me right back, and like you said about things like the jokes he makes at the party as Tom Ace... I can appreciate those more now,
yeah, for sure,
than I did when I was a kid, because when I was a kid, it was all about alrighty then and catching bullets in my teeth,
yeah,
and haha, she's a man.
Yeah.
But, you know, now I can watch it and go, oh, yeah, the whole little runner of the food poisoning lawsuits and everything like that. That's a funny moment. And
yeah,
the thing with the landlord and the palm fronds, you know, all those sort of things. I can still appreciate where the comedy was in this movie. And I mean, I can still get behind like a 65-70, and there is a little asterisk of there that if mm-hmm. you are offended by not being trans myself, I don't know how this is offensive. So I can't say that it's offensive because of this reason and this reason, but I know there's something wrong there. Yeah. I just can't fully comment on what is wrong.
Yeah, for
but
sure.
I'm still entertained enough by the movie that, and I look at it and don't think it's that wrong. I don't know. Yeah. It's tough. I can still get behind a 65-70 though, because it still entertained me.
Yeah.
Quite a bit after all these years.
I'd agree. I would probably fall along the same line. I think, like, I don't know, I would echo a lot of what you said. I think that, for me, it's just, I love that. I love this era of Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, he kind of lost me when he went his more serious route, and I've kind of recently gotten more back into him, like, I watched that show Kidding, and...
I've never seen that one yet.
Oh, it's good. It's good. But it's just, like, I love... A man who can do that much with his face
mm-hmm.
should just lean into that
yeah.
a lot. Like, it's almost to me kind of sad in some ways that but at the same time, I totally understand, like, you know, you don't want to get typecast and all that stuff and end up doing these goofy movies
yeah.
forever. Like, he's clearly an artist and he wants it to be taken seriously. But yeah, I don't know. Watching Ace Ventura and seeing those, like, that just over the top physical comedy and the, you know, the funny voices and the funny faces. It's just, yeah, I really love that. I like this movie a lot.
It's almost like Truman Show was the tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
Because before Truman Show, you had Dumb and Dumber and you had Liar Liar and, you know, all this over-the-top physical comedy. And then Truman Show is where he started being a little less goofy. You get the occasional taste.
Yeah.
Like Fun with Dick and Jane or something like that. But yeah, ultimately, I see what you mean. Yeah, it's... Pre-Truman Show, I think you might have even had both Ace Venturas in there. And, I mean, Ace Ventura 2, that's a whole different animal right there. No pun intended.
Yeah.
But, like, the birth scene out of the robotic rhinoceros, like...
I was going to say, I actually have never seen Ace Ventura 2.
Oh,
For whatever reason. I don't know why, but I haven't seen it. It's on Netflix, so I'll probably watch it eventually. But
This one feels a little bit smarter, if that's okay. possible. Yeah. So... Well, there we go. That's Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, and that's our show for this week. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is, well, tell your friends, share our posts. Word of mouth is the lifeblood of a podcast trying to get noticed out there. Or if you want to go above and beyond to help us out, go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcast on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't matter what you say, but those 5 stars, they drive us up the charts and they help us get noticed.
And do yourself a favor and check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our podcast episodes as well as all our social media. We have Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Do us a favor and go like our posts, comment on our posts, share our posts, give us your cheers, give us your jeers. Yeah, just come along for the ride.
And if you would like to be a producer of the show and donate to us, you can go to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne and become part of our Patreon community. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thanks for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.